This episode of Behind the Video is brought to you by the Independent Media Network. The Independent Media Network helps journalists and content creators create their own jobs by building sustainable online businesses. If you're an unemployed or underemployed journalist or content creator, visit IMNCT.com for more information.
Hey everybody, welcome back. We are back for Behind the Video. This is episode number 61, and joining me as always is my lovely and talented co-host, Tim Street. Hey Tim, how are you today? What's happening in Los Angeles?
It's a beautiful day. I'm outside enjoying the weather. I still can't get used to your command center there at Behind the Video HQ. It's massive.
It grows and grows, and my wife is grateful. By the way, John Fannin's joining us also he's from Framingham, Massachusetts. He's a musician used to be with the band New England, and he's now got a solo album out that he's basically self-marketing. We really were interested in hearing about what he's got, so we'll hear from him in a few minutes and kind of talk about the music industry. We spent a lot of time talking about video, but not necessarily about music, so we're going to hear more about that. But yeah, Tim, this thing has been growing as like a, not like a weed, but more like a one of those invasive plants. So
it looks like a bed of weeds and cables and boxes and junk.
It is getting to that point. I want to be able to consolidate, because part of the problem is that
you make it look so easy, Juan.
It is, and you know what? It's a matter of just hooking things up together. And it's funny, when I was in junior high school, I think I told you this, I had a cable access show, and we didn't have a lot of things to work with. So it was basically you had a camcorder, and then you had to hook it up to stuff and try to get things to work. And so this is really working within the limitations of the hardware I have. And
so for the podcasters who are listening to the show, Juan has a shot of three laptops. They're about 4 or 5 boxes on his table and cables everywhere.
Yes.
it does not look like a streamlined process at all compared to the old days of us just flipping open the laptop and doing a Google Plus Hangout.
Yeah, it's been a little bit of work to get us functional here. And I'm this has been a good exercise, because the fact is it is possible to do it. Right now there are needs to have additional pieces of hardware. So we've got this computer here is the streamer. And then I've got 2 boxes here from Blackmagic that actually reduce the need for an additional computer. You guys are in on this one, and then all the web sites that we're going to be talking about, I pop up on this guy right here. So there is still a little bit of stuff you have to hook up to it, but my next thing I want to try to find is a box that will do the streaming components. I don't need to have a computer dedicated to that task, and that'll reduce wires and make our lives a little bit easier. So we'll see how things come together here. So, but I did want to, first of all, before we get into John, talk a little bit about 2 stories that came up between this week and last week. The first is hyper-local news taking a big, I don't know if it's a big hit or maybe more of a correction with Patch.com laying off about half of its workforce and shuttering probably half of its sites. Tim, do you have a Patch.com out in Los Angeles?
You know, we probably do, and I want to say I'm somehow tied to Patch, involved with Patch in some way, but I never used it. It was just one more thing for me to pay attention to, and it's part of AOL, right?
It is, yeah. So what happened was Patch started, it was actually a Googler that started AOL, started Patch. AOL liked the model. They started with 5 local sites, and then they tried to balloon it into something more. And I think their plan was to offset the local revenue with national revenue, so that they would aggregate these millions of Patch sites that they have around the country and then be able to sell national and local ads on the sites. And, you know, in theory, it sounds like a great idea, except the fact that local doesn't scale very well. It's really, really difficult to do. And Patch really replicated, and I'm a little biased because I'm in a business that is doing something different than they're doing, but they tried to replicate the old model, which was a lot of middle management and a lot of people, you know, kind of directing things. And the local editors really had to do what upper management wanted them to do, not what the community necessarily was looking for. So they're now in the process of reorganizing, having the sites that are profitable remain, and those that aren't will be partnered up with other entities or shut down completely. So local is hard, really hard.
Local is hard. There's also global local. And this is something I bet John could talk about, even though he doesn't realize it yet. But as a musician, let's say you play an instrument. John, what instruments do you play?
A guitar is my main instrument, but I play all kinds of instruments, a lot of keyboards, bass.
So as a musician, do you have friends that may be professional, semi-professional, that are into guitar, that are scattered all over the world?
Yes, absolutely.
And do you have certain manufacturers or suppliers of guitar parts or accessories that are scattered across the world?
They are. You know, I would have been more involved, you know, with that years ago. But I certainly, you know, I deal with like music stores, you know, whether it's in L.A. or Canada or New York.
Right, right. And so that's a global, local, if that makes sense. Scuba diving is the same way. So there will be scuba divers that know that there are certain dive places that are great, or there might be a dive gear company that's making a certain new gear thing that's of value to the scuba diving. So I think local needs to be approached in a new way now, so that it's not only about your local news. Oh, I heard gunshots in the neighborhood. Was it firecrackers? Was it gunshots? But also, you know, how do I find this new, you know, tuning device that is so cool? It's part of my iPhone. It's an app, and I can tune my guitar with my iPhone. It's pretty crazy.
Very crazy.
And it's all niche. It's all niche and finding locality. So John, we wanted to bring you into the discussion here. And now you were part of a top 50 Billboard charts band at one point, right?
I mean, we were a world classic band in the late 70s, early 80s.
And that group was New England, right? That was
New England. Our most famous song was Don't Ever Want to Lose You, which was a top 40 Billboard hit, and which was pretty cool that it got even to there, because, you know, it was a power rock kind of song in the days of Kenny Rogers and Donna Summer being on the radio.
And describe like what the industry was like back then. I mean, what was, you know, you got signed, right? You had to work hard. You got discovered. You got the record contract. You had the tours. You opened for big bands. Then you became the prime act. And what was that like? I mean, was it easier? Was it harder? What was it like?
It's much, much harder. You know, everyone didn't have a recording studio in their basement. if you didn't get a record deal with a major label, you had no career. So it was a huge accomplishment to get to that point. You know, we did record demos to attract the record companies to the band. The way the magic really started happening for us was this guy by the name of Rick Aliberti saw us in our rehearsal hall in Braintree, Massachusetts, and he was vice president of Ocoee Management. And Ocoee Management was a global management company. And his most famous artist was Kiss. And so then Bill Ocoee came down to see us. He loved the band. Paul Stanley of Kiss came down to see us. Then all of a sudden we had not just record representatives, but we had presidents of record companies coming down to see the band. People like Clive Davis, who, you know, they can't be a larger icon from the business point. But anyways, and it just all started happening. You know, we got signed to a label. It was Infinity Records, which was a boutique sort of super label that MCA had started. The record came out. It just hit the charts. We were on a national tour with Kiss, and our career just started. We were younger.
Everything lives on the internet, doesn't it? You can never escape it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you just sort of just found that and picked that right up.
Yeah, it did. It just comes right up there. So now, how did marketing work back then? So, and it still works to some degree like that now. So it's not like it's completely dead. But you were signed, you know, you had all that work to get to that point. Now you're a signed band, and I guess they would give you a cut of whatever you sold.
Yeah.
A very, very small cut, probably, right?
It was a very small cut. And of course, radio was so important then. If you didn't get on the radio, you really, you know, you couldn't get out of the gate. And we were all over the radio, so that really helped. And even when we were opening for artists, because of the exposure on radio, even though we were opening for artists in major arenas, there was a substantial, you know, there may have been 4,000 or 5,000 of those 15,000 people that were there to see us. But now it's like, you know, as I'm with my solo career now and promoting my own record, you know, the radio isn't part of it. That's where the internet comes in to help.
And it's a lot more niche now, right? So, you know, Tim and I were talking last week about television ratings and how, you know, back in the day, a network show like Who's the Boss or The Love Boat or something would get 25, 30 million viewers because there was this small group of gatekeepers kind of, you know, saying, all right, here you go.
Yep.
Now you're finding yourself in a very different scenario. So you have the solo album. What's the album called?
The album is called Saved All the Pieces.
And you can find that at johnfannon.com, I'm assuming, right?
You can find that on there, and then also on iTunes and Amazon, and the new term that I've learned is digital stores.
Right,
digital stores all over the world.
You can stream it, and so here it is, and you can check on it, and you know, so now it's different. So now you've gone out, you engineered this yourself, you have people help you, obviously, but you went out and did this. You paid to press the CDs, and have been putting it up all over these different things. So what's it been like trying to find all those fans out there that? That know who you are, that may not know that you've got this new project. How has it been?
The world audience is still there. I haven't reached the masses yet, but I've been, you know, filling the orders myself, you know, when they come in. And, you know, it's been all over Europe, the Netherlands, Sweden, Switzerland, Germany, France, the UK, all over Canada, Japan. So they're not big numbers, but people are finding me through the social media. And, you know, just Googling around. And so that's what I'm reaching so far. Now I need to, you know, get to more of the masses.
Are you finding people are associating you with other musicians? Because I always find that's a way that discovery works. If you like this band, you may like this.
That is part of it. I think so far the people that are discovering me or rediscovering me are New England fans. Mm-hmm. So that's probably the primary thing right now. But now the music, and it's been getting some great reviews. The music is some of my earlier roots. It's very Beatlesque, with some Pink Floyd thrown in there, and then of course just some of my own stuff. So speaking of relating to that, though, I am on this Django Radio, which is an internet radio station, and you know, the way that works, you sort of pick the groups, the stations that you want to be on. So kind of what you're saying is, so I'm targeting myself to Pink Floyd stations and the Beatles, and you know, I'm reaching thousands and thousands of people, and you know, hundreds of them become your fans. It's very interactive. But the downside of that is that I'm discovering is in this world, they don't buy records. That's their source for music. They may love your music and they want to tune in and hear it, but they don't buy it.
Yeah.
That's sort of the internet radio people.
And that speaks to the problem too, because, you know, if you're Lady Gaga and you put your new single up on YouTube like you did this week, you know, you're going to get, you know, $5-6 per 1,000 plays in ad revenue that happens. But, you know, for an artist that has a specific genre, who doesn't have the marketing muscle of a Lady Gaga behind him, it's different, right? I mean, you could stream this stuff, but you'll never be able to eat, right?
So, well, it's absolutely true. So, you know, I definitely need to find the, you know, the mass market, and certainly performing. You know, performing helps. You know, around the Boston area, I can sell out like a 200 seat venue. And as a solo artist on stage, that does very well. But I need to, you know, I need to move on, and I'm hoping that's where I'll start making some more income is the actual performances and selling.
Well, are you performing at all on YouTube? Because I have seen that, you know, folks who are creating content online will draw people, and so people that are making videos, whether it's just them playing in their bedroom on a YouTube channel or blogging in text about things that they've done on the road, that content creates traffic and drives sales.
Yes, no question. There is a lot of my actually performances on YouTube. It hasn't got a lot of exposure yet, but you know what's amazing is my son takes most of them on his iPhone. And he posts them up there, and the quality is pretty darn good.
Yeah, it's amazing that the camera on the iPhone is better than the cameras we had growing up.
Yeah. Oh, it's
higher
true.
Quality.
And the audio is very good, and it's just a tiny little microphone.
And Tim, let's talk about that for a second too, because I've seen in my own stuff that and of course now we're raising production hardware. I don't know about quality, but raising production hardware for our show. you know, we've seen in many instances that these iPhone videos, especially with undiscovered artists or independent artists, tend to do better with crappy sound and crappy kind of video, right? I mean, is that something John should be doing, is just throwing more of this stuff up there and building a subscriber base around that? What should he do, given his, again, his target audience may not be the typical YouTube audience either, right? But what would you suggest he do?
It's really about a conversation, right? So the fans of the band New England want to connect in some way with the band, with the members of the band. They want to feel special. They want to feel part of it. They want to go backstage. I mean, you think of all the things that a fan wants. You're able to give that to them at arm's length via the internet. And so if you can have a Twitter account and retweet one of your fans' tweets, they're going to feel really special. And they're going to share that. And they're going to tell their friends that they got retweeted by somebody that they really love and care about and whose music they enjoy. So it's really thinking about the things that you can do with social media to reach out to the fan base and give them the things that they want. I mean, just make a list of what you know that your fans want and think of how many things on those lists are within your power to do, you know, using an iPhone.
Right.
Whether it's Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, you can do a lot to make your fans feel good and special. And when you do that, they'll make you feel good and special by telling people to buy your music.
Well, that's very good advice. The retweeting thing is very good advice. I don't really do that. I do have a few followers. I do communicate with some fans, you know, in chat rooms and things like that. And you are right. It's a very special event for them.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a special event for me.
Yeah, and doing that in public rather than just in a private chat room only just amplifies what it is that you're doing, and it makes people want to engage more. You do run into the danger of having to deal with trolls, which is, hecklers. I'm sure you've had performances where you've got a drunk in the room. And, over time, you learn how to deal with the drunks.
Yeah, it's interesting that you would have to do it in this medium, too. That's funny.
Yeah, and the worst part is they're anonymous and think that they can get away with with doing more there. John, what has surprised you about this effort? Because you've mentioned in prior conversations that you're finding that you were bigger in places you didn't know you were even known, right?
Right. I knew that we had a following in the UK. I knew we had a following in Japan, very large followings. But when I started getting CD requests from like Switzerland and Sweden and Norway and the Netherlands, I was, holy cow, there's people actually out there that were New England fans. What I can't judge at this point is how big of numbers are actually there. That's what I've got to try to discover. Is it just one or two people in those particular countries? Now, UK and Japan, I know there were thousands and thousands of them.
Right, and trying to find them and reach them is really the kicker. And
I do appeal to everyone to spread the word, like the record, and a couple of times that has happened actually. But that's really what I need. I just feel this is like a grassroots, marketing promotion to get my record, known around the world.
Yeah. Well, speaking of grassroots efforts, There was a president recently who got reelected and elected the first time by a grassroots online effort, and he had some breaking news this week as well, didn't he, Lon?
He did, because as you know, there's been I'd actually really interested in hearing John's opinion on this also, because John, you may have remembered there was a big fight over SOPA, which was a bill to change the way the internet works so that record labels and movie makers can go after people that were using their content illegally or questionably illegally could come after them. So, Google kind of threw the nuclear option at this and basically didn't shut their search engine down, but they put up a little note on the very most important traffic site on the internet, which is their homepage, and said, hey, the government's going to totally screw up the internet, so you better do something about it. So as you can imagine, the bill fell apart in Congress. I talked to some members of Congress here in Connecticut who got more calls or about the same number of calls on that issue that they did than they did on healthcare. So it became that, like the calls were that intense.
Calls
too.
Are very important to congressmen. If you want to get a bill passed, the best way is to stay under the radar and not have anybody upset and calling Congress.
That's right.
But if you want to stall a bill, just get everybody you can in social media to start calling congressmen, because they don't like it when the phone rings.
They don't. And what's happening now, you may have to pick up the phone again, Tim, because the Obama administration now has been working on how to solve this problem, because there are legitimate issues of piracy here, that people are, especially in Asia and other countries out in that direction, where there's a tremendous bootleg market going on for Hollywood movies, and that's a chief export of the United States, so we shouldn't take that lightly, that there are very illegal activities going on. The problem is that there's been a very broad net in trying to criminalize activities that are more innocent in nature, and the Obama administration had put together a task force to kind of look at this issue and try to find some ways to build some compromise. And one of the recommendations they're making is to have unauthorized streaming become a felony, which, according to the Huffington Post, is the latest thing that they're recommending. And, you know, this doesn't just mean setting up your own pirate radio station and streaming New England tracks, but it is also going to apply, if the law is written the way they're talking about it, to someone doing a cover of a song on YouTube. And John, I wanted to get your take on this, because, you know, when New England was active and touring, you know, you had the bootleggers, right, who were swapping tapes around and that kind of thing.
Sure.
Was your label not crazy about that? What was the opinion of those things back then?
I think it was, you know, it was a smaller scale thing back then. I know that there were all kinds of bootleg recordings going around in Europe. But in those days, I don't think they really worried about it too much.
And now,
but now it can really eat into, you know, your potential sales.
It could, and that's especially for an independent artist like yourself. That's really, you know, that every sale counts. The other component here again is those covers. So how many bands play a cover at a local bar and not pay the royalty? What's happening now is that a lot of musicians, like Justin Bieber in particular, get noticed by covering other songs on YouTube, which would be apparently a felonious act if the law passes. So what about covers, John? Like, what's your comfort level as a musician and someone that's been in the industry? What's your comfort level with, you know, a fan doing a video, singing your song? Is that bad, good?
I guess for me, I think it is. You know, I think it's just more exposure. But I could be wrong. But someone sent me a link the other day of a Japanese club band performing New England songs. And it's fairly recent in the last few years.
Really? So it's just a band. So some video from a club
just
in Japan
a club in Tokyo somewhere.
Right.
And they're playing New England songs.
And in some ways, it keeps the music alive, right? I mean, this
exactly. I didn't really have a problem with it, but I'm sure, like on a larger scale, maybe artists do. You know, I'm thinking about I don't know if it's still up on YouTube, but a few years ago there was a guy in his bedroom playing a classical version of Stairway to Heaven. And I think it had like 10 million hits or something like that, but it was phenomenal. It's probably why it went viral. But there's a, to your point though, I guess, well, who, you know, is that illegal?
And that's,
I mean, it is illegal, but does anybody really care, I guess?
Right, and if it helps promote something, then it could work. I mean, there's a lot of artists who've seen it work. And Tim and I last week discussed an issue. There are these multi-channel networks on YouTube who basically, they help fund promising channels and give them some resources to produce more videos. And one of the biggest ones on YouTube is getting sued by a record label because of a bunch of covers that a lot of their members are putting up. And there's been a revenue issue there. And, you know, I think these are things that they could work out if the two sides would just sit down and talk to each other. What do you think, Tim?
Yeah. No, I think so. I mean, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
That's okay. No.
That's okay. Yeah, definitely there needs to be some conversation here. I think you look at the devastation that the record industry has. If they would only talked with Napster in the first place, we'd be in a different world right now. Although, I must say, we probably wouldn't have as nice of phones as we have. The whole phone industry, in my opinion, is built off the fact that the record industry failed. So I don't think Apple would be as strong today. I mean, they were not in great shape in the early 2000s. And the fact that they had the iPod that pulled them in a whole new direction. And that was because the record industry failed. They were able to come in and pick up the pieces. So there's a lot to think about there as we move forward. And, you know, taking a look at the different YouTube channels that are out there, a lot of them are music-related that are in the top ones as well as video games.
That's right. I mean, a lot of it's streaming other people's stuff, whether it's a game thing or singing a song from someone else. And topping YouTube this week, of course, though, is Lady Gaga. Neat thing here. This is what this is something for John to think about. John very smartly has on his YouTube page, he has his first single from his album up as a audio-only YouTube stream, and that's what Lady Gaga did here. I mean, this we won't play it because we'll get thrown off YouTube right now, but there is still copyright enforcement going on, guys. But she's got 12 million plays of this track, which is her latest single, and I would imagine sales are probably pretty good, but I think a lot of people now are streaming this stuff, Tim, right? I mean, this is kind of neat that this is where kids are getting their music from now, right?
Yeah, definitely. I would not be surprised to see some type of playlist that you can program and just listen to YouTube songs, you know, and that defeats the whole purpose. You know, the artist isn't getting paid, the commercials aren't being consumed, so it'll work itself out. But I think there's going to be a time we still have a lot of fits and starts to go through.
And it's just interesting how there's like this. You know, initially, the response of the record labels was to sue the crap out of YouTube, and now it's just put the singles up there and see where it goes. And John's done that. In fact, John's gone a step further here. He's got animation running in his still. So this is John's first single. We'll actually play it at the end of the show on the recorded version. You'll be able to listen to it. So you know, John, are you doing YouTube yourself? Do you have someone helping you with it?
Posting them myself, but a friend of mine actually, who is a video editor, I just gave him the still, and you know, it's not a real big thing, but I was just like thrilled when he had the water moving.
Yeah, no, it looks nice. Pretty cool in there. So some other stuff topping YouTube this week. We'll start back down at the bottom, so I always start at the top. But Lady Gaga, I thought, was interesting and apropos for our discussion. There was at VidCon, and Tim has some insight on this. There was a group of pranksters who started kind of. I guess, what was that Ashton Kutcher show? What was it? Punked?
Punked.
So they're punking YouTube stars. And they had this young woman in a hotel room who was playing the crazy fan. And I'll let it play here, Tim. You can kind of describe what was going on here.
Sure. I haven't seen this one particular, but Black Box TV, Tony Venezuela, he's great. And he did a series of pranks with different top YouTubers. Folks like Shira Lazar were pranked. And he had a super fan that just went over the top. And so they would set up interviews where the super fan would come and do an interview with the celebrity that they loved. And the super fan had an earpiece in her ear. And she would just totally be taking notes from Tony in the next room over. So you got to check these out. There's Tony. There's the gang giving some advice, so it's great. And they partnered with, I think, the Prank versus Prank folks as well on this. There's the three of them there. So check these out. They're a lot of fun to watch. And, you know, definitely scary moments for the YouTuber.
Yeah, and so this one particular episode, this one show, it's this guy Vitaly, and I haven't seen some of his stuff before, but he's apparently a YouTube celebrity, if you will. And she handcuffed his arms to his legs. Got him to take his shirt off, and I think he was about to take his pants off when they finally ended the thing. So it was definitely well done, and I feel bad for Vitaly, but maybe that'll grow his traffic. Looks like he was sort of a good sport about it. Some other things on the top 10 list: Call of Duty Ghost multiplayer. Again, I say this every week, how it's astounding how video games just become so much of a part of YouTube, and we have a story related to that also. Another one here was interesting. Number three was 10 amazing bets you'll win every time, kind of like parlor tricks you can do to impress your friends, kind of some neat stuff. This is Quirkology, Tim. He seems to got a pretty good subscriber base.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with this one. I'll have to check it out.
Yeah, he's a British guy, and he's like, you know, things that you can do in a bar to impress your friends or terrify your enemies, I guess. Number two is the Grand Theft Auto 5 gameplay video. So that's, you know, Grand Theft Auto 5, they're brilliantly marketing this one, releasing little snippets of video over time, and we'll see what happens when that comes out. I really can't play these games anymore, Tim. I got a baby in the house. I don't want her to look at this. You know, her father carjacking people. So I'll have to wait for her to fall asleep or something. But pretty neat there. So moving on to some YouTube news. PewDiePie, another gamer, is now the top subscribed YouTube channel. Pretty impressive. So he's got a subscriber base of 11 million. He's now surpassed Smosh. And John, if you ever watch this guy, I don't even understand him, but he's big. And again, it's all this video game thing. And what they're doing is, you know, in many cases, they're streaming gameplay. He's, you know, interacting with his fans, of course, but he's also working in some, you know, some comedy in the process also. He's got a huge, huge following. So, Tim, I mean, you work in this industry. There's a lot of people working hard on, you know, generating original content, you know, television style stuff. What's the reaction to all this gaming stuff doing so well? And is it changing the way people are approaching their channels?
Well, it certainly is, because it's so much easier to just put on a game, start playing a video game, and then, you know, through improvisation, be funny, as opposed to building sets, getting costumes, having a script, and getting everything approved through a corporate process. It's a pretty tough play for studios and networks to keep up with this, you know, low quality but yet high payoff audience.
Well, Tim, we got some movies coming up and actually out this weekend. So our friend who we don't know, Nikki Fink, maybe you might know her, but put together our weekend box office list here. And number five is Planes. This is week number two, cumulative total of $45.1 million and $13 million for the weekend. Elysium is on its second week, $55.7 million. I'm surprised it actually is doing better than Planes. Isn't that kind of surprising?
Yeah, it is surprising. It seems like kids would be going in droves right now.
Yeah, this is like the prime time. Get them, you know, they're getting a little stir crazy. Send them to the movies, you know. Kick-Ass 2 is in at number 3, and that is the sequel. And I've heard it's like $13.6 million for the weekend, by the way. I've heard it's pretty raw, you know, pretty raw and violent. I guess these are, you know, superhero kids. The first one, I enjoyed the first one. I thought it was a pretty funny movie, but it definitely got kind of over the top gory towards the end, but this new one apparently is like really over the top. I think didn't Jim Carrey like come out and say it was too violent after the fact?
Yeah, he did. He kind of poo-pooed his own movie.
Yeah, I'm sure his bosses were not happy about that. And number two is We're the Millers. Undoubtedly, Jennifer Aniston's involvement there. $68.8 million for that one in its second week also. And the top one is Lee Daniels' The Butler, and that came in at number one with $25 million for its opening weekend. So
that had some Oprah push behind it.
Oh, okay. Oprah's, yeah. That's what we got to do, John. We got to get you on Oprah.
There you go.
She can sell stuff, right? She gave a car away on Jimmy Kimmel's show the other day also.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so it's
yeah, you know you'd be seen by millions of people, that's for sure.
And, you know, and it speaks to the power of the gatekeepers still and the people that have, you know, big media isn't dead by any stretch. I mean, I think we're seeing a lot of growth here. Like PewDiePie is a great example. Like nobody knows who the heck he is except his 11 million subscribers. But, you know, he's making a living. Is he making, you know, as much as Oprah's making? No, but do you need that?
Right. He's making a living.
He's absolutely making a living, you know, so it's pretty wild. So we'll see what goes on there. So some news here, actually closer to home where I live in Connecticut. That is Netflix closing its Bloomfield distribution center. And what's funny, just like a year or two ago, they were making a big deal about this Netflix distribution center in the state, inviting media to come on tours and stuff. And Tim, does this speak to streaming becoming more prevalent with Netflix, or does it speak to the fact that they lost a lot of good early releases over these deals with the movie companies? Because remember, they used to get a DVD when it came out. They had it. You know, when it was sold in stores, Netflix had it and it was released. And they ended up making a deal to delay its arrival as a rentable disc so that they could push digital and push regular sales first. I think that is more to do with this maybe than streaming does. But what do you think, Tim?
I think it's a combination of both. I mean, a lot of people are streaming, you know. You take a look at Roku, at Apple TV, these devices are deploying left and right. And then a lot of TVs right now, if you're buying a new TV, it comes with Netflix already on the smart TV. So there's a lot of connected devices that are getting out there. A lot of people are watching Netflix on their iPad. I think it just it's really starting to happen to where the name Netflix is becoming a reality.
And it's interesting to see where it goes. John, are you a Netflix subscriber?
I am not. I was for a little while, but I'm not. I just don't find myself watching movies and things like that. I'm always writing music.
Right. So you're
always in the studio.
That's the content creator's curse, right? You're always making more than consuming, right?
Absolutely.
It's really interesting how that plays out like that. So, but if you were watching TV, you would see that the Breaking Bad premiere did really well for cable standards. Breaking Bad came back at a 5.9 million viewer count, according to the Wrap.com. That's a pretty good return. Again, back to this argument of viewership that, you know, they're making enough money to produce good television like this with only 5.9 million viewers. But, you know, it seems like these shows build, Tim, they kind of build an audience that continues the revenue stream. So, for example, Doug in our chat room just started watching Breaking Bad after it's been on the air for 5 years this week. So, you know, they're making money from his viewership too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the great thing about on-demand is that you can get an audience far after the show's been produced. Now, that's good and bad. It's a double-edged sword because you may bail on a show and it goes away if you look at Arrested Development, and then it builds a following online like it did on Netflix, and so they brought it back. Well, in most cases, that's not going to happen. Because the chances of you getting the cast back together is just not a reality. But I think we're going to see a lot more change in this. But it is exciting to see these audiences build and build on different platforms.
Yeah, it seems like there's a platforms that are appropriate for different areas too, right? I mean, some things work better on YouTube. I mean, you wouldn't ever think of Breaking Bad putting back episodes on YouTube for free, right? I mean, it's an appropriate venue for the appropriate thing. So, well, we will keep an eye on that. And, you know, John, that's one thing to think about, too, is, you know, Doug in our chat room just pointed out that there's people doing on YouTube and Google Plus and even in Second Life, which I had not even thought people were still using, of doing live concert events where you get your fans together, let them know, hey, we're going to stream this live on Google Plus or whatever at this time. Come in and be a part of the concert. Daria Musk is a young woman from Connecticut, actually, who is building a music career around that. She was lucky enough to get into Google Plus very early, and that kind of built it up. But that's something to consider, too, is, you know, doing a streaming concert or something that you can certainly build an event around those international fans and just trying to find the right time. You might have to play at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning.
That's a good idea, absolutely.
You know, or you could even stream, you know, a show that you're doing one night, you know, if they have enough bandwidth at the venue and they're okay with it, you know, push it out there.
We actually did stream. I was playing Club Passim June 22nd. It was actually my CD release party. And there is they do stream shows with your permission from Club Passim. So that was streamed, but that didn't all come together till so late that we couldn't get the word out to people that it was actually happening.
Yeah, there is a notification time that you really have to put into this stuff. And we found that with this show too, that you know, we try to get these event notifications out about, you know, a week or a little less than a week ahead of time so people can know to do that. The nice thing with Google Plus is that it'll send out an email to people to remind them. The challenge, of course, is that not everyone's on Google Plus, so you got to go find them on Facebook or find them, you know, whatever social network in the home country is the prevailing one. You've got to kind of track it down. So it's all a matter of just building up those social contacts. And related to that is our pick of the week, and Tim has something called Tug. Tim, you want to talk about Tug? This is kind of interesting for movie watchers.
You know, I'm totally blanking on Tug right now.
Tug was the film thing you sent me that lets you build an audience around a movie that you'd like to see playing locally.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. So let's say that you want to have a whole bunch of your friends, and I don't know that this particular movie is available on Tug, but recently I was invited to a party where somebody found a VHS recording of Ghostbusters, and it had all the commercials from the 80s in it. And so they had a party around it. And if you wanted to have a theater rented out in your hometown or some other place, you could get a movie, let's say Three Amigos. You wanted to have everyone come watch Three Amigos at Halloween or a scary movie at Halloween. Well, Tug allows you to set up an event, get a whole bunch of people signed up, and then they'll rent out the theater. They'll get the theater taken care of so that you can have a screening of this movie in the theater that you want to have it. So it's build the audience first and then have your private screening event using Tug. So it seems like a fun little thing. I don't know how well it will go on, but for theater owners, it's a great way for them to take a theater that may not be performing that well on a weeknight and turn it into a sold-out theater.
Especially for cult films, too, where there's kind of a community around the film. This could be a really, really fun little thing to do. So it's a neat idea.
And for films, you know, for studios, it's a great way for them to push their back catalog.
Right, exactly. And something where they have, you know, they still have that those business relationships with those theaters, and that is one way they can still make the kind of money that they hope to make, even in the digital era. So, well, that will bring us to the end of our discussion this week. John, where can people find you and the album and connect with you?
Yeah, they connect with me on John Fannin Music on Facebook or Twitter. They can get me there. But as far as music, johnfannin.com. And, you know, there's, there you go, right there, the store, and so it's history, reviews, and a lot of info about me and my past, and you can listen to the music and see if you like it.
And you can buy it on Amazon and iTunes also, but the CD is still the nice, the tangible
The CD,
thing.
Yeah, the CD right now is just available on my website, and I've been, you know, packing them myself, signing them, and doing really well with that, but.
So if you want the real experience, John will package it for you and ship it.
Package
to you
it for you
by the artist. I mean, you
with a note.
With a note. Whatever you want it to say, he'll put it in there. So
right, exactly.
You can't get more personal than that. So check him out at johnfannin.com. And Tim, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at One Tim Street.
And you can find me, Lon Seidman, L-O-N-S-E-I-D-M-A-N, on Twitter, or you can get us on our the show on our Google Plus community, behindthevideo.com. And if you go in there, we will notify you whenever we do the live show, which is every Sunday morning at 11:30 a.m. Eastern time, 8:30 a.m. Pacific. And we have a YouTube channel, a Stitcher channel, an iTunes channel. We are everywhere, so just search for us, and you will find it. The new shows, audio shows, go up around Wednesday each week. So that will do it for this edition of Behind the Video. We are a wrap.
Stories for this episode were compiled by producer Jason Perrier. Follow him on Twitter at JASONPERRIER. Behind the Video is a production of Ape Digital Incorporated and the Independent Media Network, LLC. All rights reserved.